Okay, I'm gonna start standing up because I've noticed that other people do that, but pretty soon I'll have to sit down because I hate them holding late today. But anyway, welcome. Okay, so you saw the description. I've never taught at Holden on demon possession before exactly, but this is something that I had a class on this past semester at the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, and the students were simply great. So it's the situation that Jesus' miracles, which is how the Catholic Church and others talk about what Jesus' healing is, can pose problems for people of faith who also are involved with religion and science and know the importance of science on several fronts. And I thought I would just start by reading as a provocative beginning here. My colleague Philip Hefner at the Lutheran School of Theology, who teaches systematic theology and religion and science, he's retired now, but absolutely wonderful, has written a number of books, and founded the Zygon Center for Religion and Science at the seminary where I teach, where we try to help students do religion and science. He published an article in Newsweek magazine in 2000 that was quite provocative, and it was called Why I Don't Believe in Miracles. And he's an ELCA pastor, absolutely wonderful, and he himself has a disability. He's now in a wheelchair, but when he was teaching at LSTC, he walked with a limp, and he said here in this article, my 40-year-old dialogue with scientists as part of my study in religion and science has not made miracles any easier to accept. He talks about as a child why he couldn't. I pray for my friends and loved ones regularly. I rejoice when blessings go to them, but I have no confidence that my prayers change the course of nature. A good deal of talk about miracles is repugnant to me and seems almost blasphemous. And then he talks about watching TV preachers. You know, I'm sure we've all had that experience where they say, if you really believe in Jesus, be healed. There's two problems with how miracles are sometimes constructed. And I guess what I want to say is we don't need to construct them this way. First of all, is if the idea is that God acts contrary to nature by healing some people, then you're going against the idea that God created the laws of nature. God created the world with order and that it follows certain natural laws, and you don't want to have a chaotic God who suddenly acts contrary to nature. And, all right, so let me just read this. A good deal of talk about miracles is repugnant to me. I remember watching TV evangelists recounting a story of a motel. It seems that a Christian woman didn't show up that night for work because her mother had a vision that she should stay home. The evangelist said the vision was the miraculous intervention of God, and the gunman entered the motel and killed three people. So the question is, if you want to say that God has power to intervene in nature, then why did God save only this one woman and not the other three people that were killed? So the kind of individualistic interpretation of miracles is the other problem that can seem really dangerous, I would say, is that if God has the power to intervene at any point in the laws of nature and change the course of nature, then why are only certain people healed and not others? And this is the kind of question that disability advocates will raise very powerfully. So I'm going to put this one article on or in the library. I don't know how you put some on reserve, so I'll just set it in there. But this is for tomorrow. If any of you are interested, a Lutheran systematic theologian named Sharon Betcher has written a very powerful article here, and she also has books. She teaches at Vancouver School of Theology. Anyway, this one is called, it's a pretty famous article, Disability and the Terror of the Miracle Tradition. I can't remember what her disability is. Something with her leg, but the same thing. If God could at any moment intervene and heal everybody's limp and problems, then why not me? And she says the miracle stories often get used against people with disabilities. So, but we'll talk more about that tomorrow. So I have noticed in my Gospels classes, well, let me just say, here's some of the things that I bring to this study and why I'm interested in this. First of all, I got involved with the Lutheran World Federation in preparation for the 2003 assembly, and the theme of that assembly was for the healing of the nations, and it was based on a verse in Revelation 22, chapter or verse 2, that I work on a lot, the tree of life for the healing of the nations, and the Greek word there is therapeuo, like therapy. And I was part of a collective that wrote Bible studies for that assembly. And on our team was a woman from Brazil who had had polio as a child, so she was confined to a wheelchair. And she really helped introduce to me the distinction between cure and healing that I continue to work with, and I'm sure many of you do as well. She said, look, Barbara, I know I'm never going to get cured of this polio that I got as a child. I'll always be in this wheelchair. But for me, healing is full restoration to community, full inclusion, and it's much more than that. So that's a distinction that a lot of medical anthropologists work with as well, the distinction between disease and illness, and perhaps most importantly, the distinction between cure and healing. And so we have to talk about what's going on in the Gospels and with Jesus' healings. What is it? But ever since that assembly, the Lutheran World Federation, I've been really working on this idea of healing, how to make sense of it with Jesus' ministry. Because certainly in the Gospel of Mark, especially, but all the Gospels, the whole first half of the Gospel is about Jesus' healing. I mean, it's a very important part of his ministry. So that's the second thing. I teach Gospels pretty much every year, you know, intro to the Gospels. And I notice that when we get to those healing stories, students sometimes, rightly so, I'm sure many of you preachers would say this as well, you know, it's hard to know what to do with these healing stories. Are you going to talk about them as miracles where Jesus acts contrary to nature or what? And interestingly, the Greek word that is often used for Jesus' healing is the same as the word for save. It's the Greek word sozo. Like the woman with the flow of blood in Mark chapter 5, Bartimaeus, who's blind, in chapter 10 of Mark's gospel, he is saved or he's healed. Which word is it? Well, it's the Greek word sozo. So that's a different word from therapeuo that's used in Revelation 22. But it's really interesting to think, wow, maybe salvation and healing have a lot more in common than we sometimes hear in English. Because what do you tend to think of salvation as? I mean, what's sort of the stereotype? If are you saved, what does that mean? What would saving look like?
Going
to heaven, right?
Going to heaven, yeah.
That's what saving is? Well, it's so interesting. In the Bible, basically, there's nothing about salvation meaning going to heaven. It's really different. So we have to talk about that. But when I start working with the students then, okay, the same word for save is the word for heal in many of these stories, not all of them, then what does that say about salvation? Do we need a more holistic understanding of salvation as being something that happens to people in this world, in this life, restoration to community, and much more? So I'll just throw out this proposal, which is that I think we should do away with the word miracle. I think that's the trip up here. And in fact, Phil Hefner at the end of this article says, I really cannot believe in miracles in the conventional sense, but I do believe in blessings. They happen every day. So if by miracle, and it has been the Catholic Church's definition, you know, for a saint to be canonized, they've got to have done miracles. And the definition of miracle we get from the philosopher David Hume, back several centuries, which is this idea that it has to be something contrary to nature. But that really is not the biblical understanding of healing. And I think we have to walk back from that and try to understand Jesus' healings in a broader context of the ancient world and what's meant by that. And it's much more. So don't get trapped in this idea that miracles have to be contrary to nature. Okay, furthermore, Jesus is not the only healer in the ancient world. And that was not what made Jesus unique in early Christian understanding. I remember when I left here in 1988, I had been pastor at Holden, 86 to 88, then I went to go to graduate school at Harvard. And that spring, we went on a trip to Greece and Turkey, and we visited all these healing sanctuaries of the Greek god Asclepius. And I was shaken by this. Somehow I'd gotten through seminary. I didn't realize there were other healers in the ancient world. You know, I really did think this is what makes Jesus unique. And I remember saying to my professor, who was a Lutheran pastor in Helmut Kester, you know, well, gosh, if, you know, Asclepius is doing all these healings, and then there's this other guy in the first century, Apollonius of Tyana, you know, what makes Jesus unique? And, you know, we talked about that. But there, clearly in the ancient world, there were a number of healers. And you could even say Jesus is part of a movement of healers, but he's not the only one. So that whole question of whether you want to pin miracles on him and say nobody else does miracles, no, that simply historically is not the case. It's important to say the ancient people believed in a spirit world. They would be much more like traditional cultures today. They believe in a world that has spirits and powers in it. And Jesus wasn't the only one who knew how to bring about healing. There are things that are unique about Jesus' healing that we looked at. For example, it's striking that he doesn't seem to charge money to heal people. That's an important distinction because, you know, other people were obviously charging it as business. And the other thing about Jesus' healing is he's proclaiming the kingdom of God having arrived. So it has a, what we call an eschatological dimension. It's the future of God breaking in these healings. That's a definite added dimension in the way Jesus talks about healing. Just a couple other things. This whole question of disability, we'll get in that tomorrow. But just to say, I remember, I think part of why I was so scared to deal with healing was one of my first years here at Holden when I was a waitress, I think. That was at the height of the sort of charismatic movement. And I remember there was a woman on staff, a young person with me, who was on antipsychotic drugs, but she could be up here and be at Holden. See, Sharon and Ted probably remember this too. You guys were up here those same years. Anyway, but somebody convinced her that if you really believe in Jesus, it means you don't need to be on drugs. And she had to go out on an evacuation. I mean, so we've had this idea sometimes in Christianity that drugs and medicine are part of the healing work of what the church is about today. And then on the other hand, there are people who have said, no, it's not. And if you really believe in Jesus, you don't need medicine. And this isn't part of that. And this is, in some ways, the historical divide between mainline churches and Pentecostal movements, for example. Everybody believed in healing. I mean, Luther, Calvin, they all really believed in the importance of healing. But in, and Catholics, I mean, but in these traditions, as modern medicine evolved, then they kind of went in the direction of building hospitals, medical missions, having doctors, nurses, etc. And as a sort of reaction to that, then Pentecostal started in the early 20th century with this idea, well, why don't we still believe in spiritual healing? Isn't that part of it as well? So those sometimes get played off against each other, but it's very important to say everybody believes in healing. It's just maybe we can come up with an understanding that holds all these together theologically. A couple years ago, I'm just telling you more of how I got into this topic that I never was brave enough to undertake. I got accepted into a seminar on human evolution, and it was called a boot camp for theologians to go to Notre Dame University for 3 weeks intensively to understand the human evolution fossil record of how, you know, we came on the scene, and it was funded by the John Templeton Foundation. And that was really, really interesting because it was different from what I had learned in evolutionary anthropology some 40 million years ago when I was at college. Let's see, when was that? 72, how many years ago? Anyway, because I grew up with this idea that maybe some of you did too, of the naked ape, you know, that competition was at the crux of who we are as humans, you know. Dog eat dog, you know. But now what evolutionary anthropologists are discovering is that in the very early human fossil records, you know, like 300,000 years ago, now with the cave that was found in South Africa a couple years ago, it's called Naledi, so that goes back a million years, that humans are caring for one another. If you want to call these humans, proto-humans, whatever, the you know, we are Homo sapiens sapiens, And our ancestors, back to about 100,000 years, were Homo sapiens, you know, and Neanderthals are in there too. But that all of these species of proto-humans show in the fossil record evidence of caring for people with disabilities, with severe disabilities. And so now books are being written, this one by an evolutionary anthropologist named Penny Spikens, How Compassion Made Us Human. So it's much more focused now, looking at the fossil records, that we're seeing evidence of altruism and compassion as part of what is the essence of human, and that includes healing, caring for people with disabilities, also burials of people who are dead, which the animals don't do, but people do, so that there's evidence for cooperation, altruism, and compassion going back as far and as prominently as competition, so that we should stop thinking about ourselves as, you know, this naked ape model, and start understanding that that altruism and compassion is very much part of who we are. So the project I was working on for that was a project on healing. And it was very interesting then to look at some traditional cultures and evidence in the fossil record and sort of cross-cultural anthropology about shamanism and the importance of the spirit world in human imagination and the evolution of higher cognitive power of memory. One really wild article on how singing was part of contributing to humans' larger brain power. So singing around the campfire, there's an article called How Meditation Made Us Human, but you start to realize the spiritual dimensions of early humans' evolution are more important than I learned back in anthropology class, at least. And this can be really interesting for how we start to think about Jesus, Jesus healing, compassion, altruism today. So I'm just throwing out all this stuff because I don't have any answers for you, but I have a bunch of topics here. How's that? Then furthermore, that brings us into the cross-cultural medical anthropology study. Let me just ask, how many of you are medical professional? I know some are doctors or nurses or medical social workers or other stuff. Okay, several. How about psychiatric, okay, uh-huh. And I know some of you are pastors. How many are pastors or religious professionals here? Okay. Well, anyway, what has been really interesting is to realize from the field of medical anthropology, this guy named Arthur Kleinman started the whole thing, that the whole way we view disease and illness and responses to it, medicine, is culturally constructed, that other cultures in other parts of the world do not view medicine in the same way that Western medicine does, and that it's, you know, a construction, which doesn't mean it's not true and important, but it just is to say, if we want to understand, for example, what's going on in the Bible with Jesus and this whole question of spirit possession, demon possession, it might help to look at how medical anthropology looks at the way medicine was constructed in the ancient world, which is really different from how we view it today. And even now today, some of the stuff, so one of the books I used in this class that I taught that I'll talk a little bit about tomorrow, this is from Africa. Actually, it's edited by a guy at the World Council of Churches, In the Name of Jesus, Healing in the Age of HIV. Edited by Ezra Chitanda at the World Council of Churches. But this is this huge question of how you can help people understand drugs to be part of healing, especially with HIV/AIDS, when you have to stay on antiretroviral drugs for the rest of your life. And in African traditional cultures, this is a book of Bible studies by African theologians grappling with this issue, how to not take that one response that I saw on the, you know, with the woman in the 70s here, you know, if you really believe in Jesus, you won't take drugs anymore. But in fact, helping people see if you really believe in Jesus, that means these drugs are created for your healing and very important to you. But it's a really interesting question. But the way that medicine is constructed anthropologically to respond to people in traditional societies really varies. Okay, and then the final thing I want to bring to this that I think is perhaps key to what we're going to do today with talking about demon possession is liberation theology. And I talked about that last night in my sermon a little bit, that Jesus and everybody in the ancient world is living under Roman imperial occupation, and that a lot of what Jesus is doing in casting out demons is overturning evil powers in the world, and that includes political powers as well as spiritual powers, and they might be more related than we sometimes realize. So the text we're going to look at with the casting out of the demon, the Gerasene demon, is a good example of that pretty much every New Testament scholar agrees on. So, okay, with all of that as a kind of setup, let's get started on demons and evil powers here. and maybe I'll start by showing this video. If I'm successful, great. If not, so let me just tell you about this video. This is one that is from public television, and it's called Your Healing, a Sacred Matter. And I think it's in total about an hour and a half. I used it with my students. It's got different episodes that are from different cultures about how medicine is constructed. So there's a really good opening one with a black church community on nutrition and how healing and nutrition is so important. One of the segments that's really moving to me that I hope I can show at the end here today, but my technology is terrible, is on the Navajo reservation. A doctor and a healer working together for people's health, just looking at how spiritual healing and healing are constructed and understood in Navajo culture. That's not just a matter of medicine in the Western sense. But this little segment that I'm going to show right now is a physician at Georgetown University who's also a priest. I can't remember what order he's from. He's Catholic, some kind of priest. And he's in internal medicine. And he's one of the featured physicians in this. His name is Daniel Silmacy, and he was with me in a different Templeton Grant project called Enhancing Life. But he talks about, an earlier scene shows medical students learning from him how to talk to people about people's spiritual lives, because that might be part of what a patient brings to getting treatment. But this little segment I'm going to show is, hopefully, if I have it queued up correctly, is just a glimpse of the sort of history of how Western medicine came to separate the medical dimension from the spiritual dimension of healing, and how great Western medicine is. Obviously, very, very important. We're so glad. But yet that there's this bifurcation then that sets up miracles as a kind of problem. So this is just a little clip that they're doing on kind of the history of medicine, if I can get it to go correctly.
I find that medical history is a window by which one can look at several different aspects of society. The religious approaches to healing, the medical theories that have defined disease, the way in which people have developed patterns of caregiving, all those come together to make an interesting mix of differing cultures, differing ways of looking at medicine and how it exists in our world.
The whole notion of health care, the idea of caring for those who are sick, really has its roots within religious beliefs and practice. Even this white coat that I have on here, is really a descendant from the garment of the priest.
We know that the Talmud came to require that every community of Jews have a physician. We know that there were physicians in the temple in the first century.
The Talmud comes after the Bible, and the Talmud concerns law. There are huge sections of the Talmud which deal with the aspect of health. Very, very intricate ideas and explanations of health. The Pharisees made many contributions to Jewish life. One of the most important contributions that they made was this statement: when it comes to saving a human life, all religious law is abrogated. This applies to modern Jewish medicine. If you take sick on Shabbat, on the Sabbath, when you are ordinarily forbidden to ride, Jewish law commands that you must be taken by an ambulance to the hospital. And so saving a human life and health actually takes rank above Jewish observance.
The New Testament is not filled with a lot of seas being split or bushes burning. It's really sick people who come to Jesus and are healed. Those are the predominant miracle. And so I think it's an interesting question to ponder why it is that healing is the miracle of choice of the New Testament. And I think it's because healing itself is symbolic of the kind of restoration of right relationship that is the sort of universal reconciliation that Jesus, I think, is preaching, is offered to the whole world through his...
That's Daniel Sammacy. I think they're going to use his name.
When Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door of the Wittenberg Church in 1517, he started not just a religious reformation, but a revolution that influenced many aspects, perhaps all aspects of European society. And of course, there was bound to be an influence on medicine and healthcare. Luther and Calvin believed that God had given medicine as a gift, that God healed through medicine. And one finds that Protestants encouraged training for medicine, encouraged doctors, and sometimes encouraged new ways.
But as medicine became more scientific, as something like pathological anatomy began in the 16th century, when autopsies began to be done, when the focus of medicine became on explaining in a scientific way what was going on and causing the diseases, this was, on the one hand, a great breakthrough that one could understand in a physical way that could help patients what was the problem. But it also became, in some ways, the beginning of the sort of gradual dissociation of the relationship between religion and medicine.
Descartes is remembered as the person who split mind from body. René Descartes was part of a group of philosophers in the 17th century who were attempting to put philosophy on a new basis, a basis that would be rooted in reason and in facts, except for the human mind, which Descartes said would not be part of the new natural philosophy. The church could look after the human mind. The human mind, he didn't use the word mind, he talked about the soul. René Descartes was part of the set of movements that we sometimes call the scientific revolution.
With the advent of scientific medicine in the middle of the 19th century, it became clear that the source of illness really wasn't moral failure. The source of illness was microorganisms. And as a consequence, the relationship between morality and medicine has changed dramatically. We no longer consider that illness is the product of moral failure.
The scientific explanation of disease became more and more the focus to the point where in the mid-20th century, when medicine becomes really incredibly powerful and efficacious, religion in some ways became even, if you will, a barrier to scientific progress.
In the early 20th century, I would argue a new kind of cultural ideal takes shape around medicine, and particularly around doctors. And I've labeled this fascination with medical doctors, a cult of doctors. It's in the language that people use, it's in the adoration that people project to medical doctors, it's in the cultural fascination with the doctor in the white coat that is tied really to the new powers of healing that medical doctors were able to harness in the first part of the 20th century.
Okay, I think we stop there.
A lot of the diet.
Okay, we can watch more of it later. But anyway, so that was just a little bit of, to get some of that history about Descartes and how scientific medicine came about, and yet some of the bifurcation that could be problematic, and especially makes it hard to talk about something like demon possession. when I was pastor up here at Holden, I'll just say my first month, so this was June of 1986. Maybe we should turn the lights back on. Thank you so much. The theologian, Roman Catholic theologian Rosemary Ruther was up here on teaching faculty, and she did an exorcism at Vespers. Were you guys here for that? No, okay. Anyway, people did not like this. She was... She rang a bell, and she had us all say, "Out, demons, out." And after that, the director just kind of quietly, Elmer Witt, said, "You know, Barbara, get more of a kind of control over Vespers, okay? So you know what you are doing." But it was interesting because she did it as a kind of political exorcism. And I actually think that that is some of what we need to look at to understand Jesus' exorcism. Now, I forget who was president there. I guess it was 1986. Who was it? Okay, well, then that explains why Rosemary Ruther was doing a political exorcism. But you just realize that it didn't go over with, Lutherans and Holden Village types. Most of us have not been part of an exorcism. And moreover, it was sort of out of context. But let me just give you some context about Jesus' exorcisms that will perhaps suggest that that might not have been as ridiculous as we, responded in 1986. Okay, so one of the textbooks I used for this class I taught is this one by a woman named Amanda Whitmer, Jesus the Galilean Exorcist, His Exorcisms in Social and Political Context. And she looks at the question of the belief in the spirit world that is very important in ancient cultures and says, using the work of a woman named Erica Bourguignon on spirit possession cross-culturally, anthropological, that there are three possible responses to spirit possession in cultures. No surprise here. For some, spirit possession is welcomed. For some, spirit possession is negative, and it's demons, and they must be exorcised. So notice, even the vocabulary, whether you call something a spirit or whether you call it a demon, will tilt the language of whether you understand it positively or negatively. And then she said the third option is our cultures that combine the two. And Whitmer thinks that that was the case in Galilee of Jesus' time, that there were understood to be good spirits and also evil spirits or demons. So the whole question then is to discern which is which. And for example, Jesus is spirit possessed. I think we would be willing to say that he's filled with the Holy Spirit at his baptism. So then though, everybody around him is wondering, is this an evil spirit? Is it Beelzebul? Who is it that's got Jesus? What is this spirit? Is it good or is it, is it God's spirit or is it an evil spirit? And that's the question that the Pharisees asked, that Jesus' family asked. So it appears that this is a culture that can understand spirits as being good or bad, and you try to discern. So another thing to say that comes out of psychiatrists, that's the other dimension we need to bring in here is psychiatry, is the work of an Algerian, or a French Algerian doctor working in Algeria named Frantz Fanon, during the French occupation of Algeria that was very brutal. And Fanon noticed that patients coming to him sometimes manifested spirit possession, what we would call, and so you have to decide, is this epilepsy or is this mental illness? What is it? How would we describe it? But what he noticed, and this is work that everybody draws on now in New Testament scholarship as well, is that when people live under oppressive colonial occupation, sometimes they manifest spirit possession as an alternative voice that is somewhat safe because you can say, that person doesn't need to be arrested and killed. They're critiquing the government or the Romans or the French because they're spirit possessed. They're possessed with a demon. But they're able to say things and manifest symptoms that help everybody sort of articulate what the oppression is all about, but it seems like certain people sort of carry that on behalf of others. And that's interesting because think of like in Jesus' time, there were other prophets as well who were prophesying against the Romans, there actually were three other people named Jesus that we read about in the work of Flavius Josephus, and one of them was a prophet who's prophesying about what's happening in the time. So prophets in the Hebrew Bible as well are spirit-filled people who seem to be able to critique what's going on in the government and in the system more than others. So that might be a dimension of spirit possession as well. And cross-culturally, Whitmer, for example, this is interesting. You might have heard about this a few years ago. She talks about in Malaysia, for example, some women factory workers, you know, in those iPhone factories or whatever, experience, quote, spirit possession on the floors of factories of multinational corporations. That is, it becomes a sort of a protest movement, but not exactly, or you can say it's mental illness, but it's everybody's sort of got it. But it's a way of sort of critiquing something without head-on saying, you know, you're an unjust multinational corporation. So what she says here, spirit possession draws on a shared beliefs within a community in order to comment on situations of great importance, which might be difficult to articulate under other circumstances. So maybe in Jesus' time, some of what Jewish communities were living with in terms of the colonial oppression by the Roman Empire manifests itself then in people possessed by spirits. And in Mark's gospel, it's very striking that a lot of all the exorcisms of evil spirits happen in public space. So it's definitely, unlike the healings, which sometimes are in a home or in private space, exorcisms happen in public space, and it appears to be offering also some kind of social critique. All right, let me just look at a couple texts with you. Those of you who got lucky and got a Bible with Apocrypha, I just want to show you a couple passages so you can see how common understanding possession by demons was. And the funniest text of all is the book of Tobit. So if you've got an Apocrypha, open it up to Tobit. No, I gotta find Tobit here. Okay. And if you don't have an Apocrypha, if you're a Protestant, and there you are. We don't have Tobit. Episcopalians even read out of Tobit at weddings, which is very interesting. So Tobit is the story of this unfortunate woman, Sarah, who is possessed by a demon named Asmodeus. Well, how many of you know the story of Tobit? It's like a little novella. I mean, it's sort of entertaining and stuff. Okay, so she's possessed by this demon Asmodeus, and every time she marries somebody, then that night, the wedding night, the demon kills her husband. Okay? So she's had seven husbands. Then there's this, so it starts out here. This book tells the story of Tobit, son of Tobiel, and he's going to marry Sarah. Okay, so what is the problem there? He might get killed, right? He could be the eighth one. Okay, so everybody's praying. Sarah's parents get his grave ready and stuff like that. Let's see, what section should we read here? So what's usually read for weddings is this prayer. So the night they get married, then before they go to bed, they pray a prayer. Okay, so let's look at chapter 8. Oh, so Tobit, though, is helped by the angel Raphael, which means helper. So Raphael, you know, angels have names and stuff, so Raphael is the healer or helper. So Raphael has given Tobit a recipe for a potion that he's supposed to make, and then he won't die on his wedding night because it's such stinky fish that it's going to repel the demon. And the demon, Asmodeus the demon, won't be able to stand this terrible smell. Okay, so somebody read to us from Tobit chapter 8 here.
Beginning?
Yeah.
When they had finished eating and drinking, they wanted to retire. So they took the young man and brought him into the bedroom.
Better do a little louder because okay. We got this buzzing noise Sorry. Here. The demon has caused this noise here.
Then Tobias remembered the words of Raphael and took the fish's liver and heart out of the bag where he'd put them and put them in the embers of the incense. The odor of the fish so repelled the demon that he fled to the remotest parts of Egypt. But Raphael followed him and at once bound him there hand and foot. When the parents had gone out and shut the door of the room, Tobias got out of bed and said to Sarah, "Sister, get up and let us pray and implore our Lord that he grant us mercy and safety." So she got up and they began to pray and implore that they might be kept safe. Tobias began by saying, "Blessed are you, O God of our ancestors, and blessed is your name in all generations forever."
All right, skip down to verse 7. Let's get to the meat of the prayer here.
"I now am taking this kinswoman of mine, not because of lust, but with sincerity. Grant that she and I may find mercy, and that we may grow old together." And they both said, "Amen, amen." Mm-hmm. Then they went to sleep for the night.
Okay, so meanwhile, Sarah's parents go out and dig the grave, for they said, you know, it's possible he will die, will become the object of ridicule, so get that ready. But then the next morning, they find them both alive. So... and they all lived happily ever after. Thank you. But anyway, there's this common understanding that demons are a reality in the world and that these are bad spirits. Another text in the Apocrypha that has this a little bit is this. So this is just one verse in the Wisdom of Solomon. So find that one. I gotta find it here. Okay. So this is really interesting because this is the start of this idea. That, I mean, so what do we think of Solomon as? What do you know about Solomon?
Wisdom, just
wise. Uh-huh. What else? He's powerful. He's David's son. Okay. So, but interestingly, in the apocryphal tradition, and then even in other books that we call the Pseudepigrapha, Solomon becomes a big healer. So it's just hinted at here in Wisdom of Solomon. Oh, it's hard to get into this verse. Well, I'll just say a little bit about, okay, so Solomon is praying, "May God grant me to speak with judgment," this verse 15, "for God gave me unerring knowledge of what exists," that's 17, "the beginning and the end and middle of times, the cycles of the year," okay, verse 20, "the natures of animals, the tempers of wild animals, the powers of spirits, and the thoughts of human beings, the varieties of plants, and the virtues of roots." So in other words, Solomon is beginning to be depicted here as someone who knows how to make potions and drugs for healing, and is a discerner of the powers of spirits. And this gets really picked up in the tradition. So it's interesting, in the New Testament, when Jesus is called Son of David, it might be that that includes a healing dimension like Solomon had. So that's, I'm not going to make you work on this here. So anyway, let me just say a few things about exorcisms. Interestingly, Martin Luther believed in exorcism, and this was brought to my attention by one of our graduates named Rob Saylor when he wrote a blog about what had happened at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, the mass shooting. You could say it about other mass shootings as well. He argues that demonology and Luther's understanding of exorcism would be a way to help Lutherans come to grips with the whole idea of structural sin, because it can help us understand that there actually are evil powers and forces in the world that are beyond an individual's will. And Luther was an Augustinian on this point. We Lutherans tend to theologize in the train of Augustine. But we don't pick up on this demon possession thing. So let me just say more about this.
How do you differentiate mental health problems with the idea of demon?
Well, I think that is a really important question. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I should ask that of all of you. But I think what Saylor at least is arguing is that demons, understood more structurally, can help us understand not just individual mental health problems, but sort of collective mental health problems, like mass shooting, mass incarceration, the evil things that people do when we're sort of possessed by a communal spirit of something. And so it helps get the focus off of the individual. I mean, individual demon possession, I don't know how to understand that. Although I've listened to other cultures, you know, I have some of that. But Saylor's suggestion is that societally, it can help us understand broader social phenomena, and that this also may have been what was going on in Jesus' time, that there was significant oppression, and that specific stories kind of bring that out. So let's just look at one story, because I know we're going to run out of time here. And this would be, this is the classic one that New Testament scholars sort of point to, that there seems to be a political dimension going on in this one as well. And that's the healing of what we call the Gerasene demoniac. So this is in Mark chapter 5. I mean, and not to say, I mean, I think there is definitely a mental illness dimension of it, but I'm just trying to shift the focus more to thinking about communities of oppression, and that demons might be part of that as well, as one way of looking at Jesus' healings. Okay, so would somebody read this one for us?
They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes, and when he had stepped out of the boat, immediately a man out of the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. He lived among the tombs, and no one could restrain him any more, even with a chain, for he had often been restrained with shackles and chains, but the chains he wrenched apart and the shackles he broke in pieces, and no one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always howling and bruising himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and bowed down before him, and he shouted at the top of his voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he had said to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." He begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now there on the hillside a great herd of swine was feeding, and the unclean spirits begged him, "Send us into the swine, let us enter them." So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the swine, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea.
Okay. So it is a story about an individual, right? This man who's been living in the tombs. But what a number of New Testament scholars point out, and most notably Richard Horsley is one in this book, Jesus and the Powers, Conflict, Covenant, and the Hope of the Poor. Let me just read this quote. "The Gospels are stories about a struggle between opposing powers, both at the political, economic level and also at the spiritual level. The power struggles rage at the spiritual level. Unclean spirits or demons have seized control of certain people. Jesus' exorcisms of these spirits involve a struggle. The gospel presents Jesus' exorcisms as dunamis." That's the Greek word that means deeds of power. And it seems like what's going on in this story is not just a mental health issue of exorcising a demon out of an individual, but rather that the Gospel of Mark might be suggesting that he carries some of what's going on in the broader oppression and injustice of the culture, and most notably, and that people reading the story would have heard some of these echoes. Most notably, for example, the word legion. You know, when the name is asked, and so why is that? Well, because legion is the name for a Roman military group of soldiers. There was a legion stationed at Caesarea on the coast. There was a legion stationed at Damascus. And people knew these Roman soldiers were the oppressive, occupying military power. So to have the demon give his name as legion is humorous and possibly echoes of some of that. So this is, you know, in the other demon possession cases, it might not be as persuasive that there's also this social political dimension, unless you, if you start to think, for example, of those women in Malaysia or whatever, that everybody manifesting demon possession might be manifesting something having to do with broader oppression. But this guy, at least, it seems like Mark is is suggesting that in the way that Jesus asks your name, the demon's name, and it's this Roman military name. And then also that when the demon comes out, or demons, they go into pigs, which in Jewish culture, of course, would be an unclean animal. So it's sort of embodying the uncleanness of the spirit, manifesting that in this herd of swine. Now, you know, I have colleagues who are so ecological, they say, you know, this is really unjust that Jesus did this, you know, always picks right in the ocean or whatever. But that in the broader sort of political context, it seems like this exorcism is making some kind of sort of social liberation connection to the Jesus movement. Uh-huh, Glenn?
Well, I feel like it's already set up a bit like that. We just had the gospel reading about Jesus says, let us go to the other side. And I think that's really evocative of different people, different powers, where there's fracture and you know, all kinds of ill that we have in our society. And I'm going to address it. We're going to go to the other side, which would have broken norms, right? And why would you want to go over there?
Yeah. He's on the Gentile side there, yeah. Uh-huh. So, yeah, and I would say in the context of, I mean, this is right where we are reading now in the Gospel of Mark. Horsley and others will point out that this whole sort of sequence of healings, sea crossings, as we had in our Gospel lesson Sunday night, and then feedings, it's all kind of memories of the Exodus now being triggered as well, because the demons of the Pharaoh and Egyptians and stuff, and the possession of the Israelite people was spiritual as well. So there's places in the Exodus story, for example, Exodus 15:26 is this famous verse. I think if somebody can look it up and make sure I've got it correct, where God says, I am Yahweh, your healer. I'm healing you from all the diseases of Egypt. So the Exodus of Egypt even is understood not just as liberation, but also as a kind of healing. And that then is what Jesus is tapping into with these movements that include crossing the sea, as you say, over to the other side, exorcising demons. Then we'll go into the two feeding stories, one on each side of the Sea of Galilee. So it's meant, I think, and then one of the healing stories of Mark, one of the early ones, the man with the withered hand, Jesus says, stretch out your hand. And that word, stretch out your hand, is the same word that is used of what Moses does in stretching out his hand to with the rod and stuff. So there's echoes of the Exodus that we don't always hear, but I think that also is a reminder that healing is more than just individual medical healing on individual people, but it might be healing a culture, it might be healing communities, and exercising evil powers is the one side of that. And then what we'll look at tomorrow is the healing people positively. That Jesus is in combat with evil powers, and he also himself is filled with good powers, God's powers, and this is what then can bring about healing. So exorcism and healing are two sides of the same coin, which is all about manifesting and proclaiming the kingdom of God, which means overturning evil powers and then also bringing about good powers in people's lives in healing our diseases. So I don't know. I mean, I'd love to hear from some of you who are mental health professionals how you read these stories. Uh-huh.
Just something that's popping into my head immediately, and I have had patients whose families have requested exorcism.
Wow.
Pediatric patients. Mm. And they were quite sincere. They wanted what was best for their child. But I think what comes to mind to me is how trauma relates to this, mm-hmm. and whether trauma is external or intrinsic to me myself. So think about shame, and shame is a belief that there's something fundamentally wrong with me versus something external that has been put onto me and then therefore can be released or gotten rid of. And so I think maybe if we think about demon possession as something external that comes mm-hmm. into me and then can be released, and I can be who I am intended to be in terms of healing, a way of releasing trauma. And if we're talking about it in communities and collective, you know, communities that are collectively victimized by systems, it's trauma. That's what we're talking about. So if we think of demon possession as a response to trauma, I think that really, really jumpstarts your conversation.
Thank you.
What does healing mean?
Thank you. That was much more eloquently put than I. And Hal Tosik, I should just say, has a book on trauma in the Gospel of Mark, and the books are more and more, we are reading texts like that through this trauma lens, that traumatized cultures and societies manifest, and that demon possession can maybe help us today also, if we begin to look at some of what's happening to our culture in terms of this trauma lens, that we need a demon to be cast out of of us as well, and it's more collective, even though it might be manifested in an individual child.
Well, and it's more hopeful than thinking about shame, right? Because shame means I thought, like, I'm done, I'm ugly, I'm yucky, I can't be changed. But demon possession means I can change it.
Thank you.
Barbara?
Do
you think that, I'm just curious, if, I mean, I hear people say all the time, I don't know why we have all these shootings going on now. And so if you think somehow there's a link between kind of the stuff that you're saying and all these school shootings and stuff that are happening.
Well, that's the suggestion in Saylor's piece here, I should say, just on the level of that it's something more than just, I guess his argument, and I think I would agree with this, it's not just individual kids who are mentally ill. You cannot say that every school shooting is mentally ill. It's something bigger than that in our culture, and whether it's the gun sales, I mean, whatever it is, I'd love to hear from you, but that it's, that to try to individualize it as mental illness is to almost trivialize what is a huge problem. And if it helps to call it demon possession, I mean, I am not comfortable with that kind of language, but I know that that is biblical language. And then, you'd say the gun manufacturers, the gun lobbies, whatever it is, it's all part of this, not willing to even limit bump stocks or whatever, stuff like that. I don't know if that frame helps us talk about evils in our society today, but at least to say there's not just individual mental illness going on in some of these.
Barbara, I appreciate you making that clear, because the mentally ill are more subject to victimization than they were victimized. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And that is very clear. And if some of these school shootings and mass shootings, almost all done by white males, were done by other people of other colors, they'd be called terrorists. Now we say, well, they're mentally ill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's much more to do with our society, and we need to take responsibility for that and address it rather than say, well, it's mental illness or it's terrorism. And so I appreciate you making that clear, that mentally ill, I've worked with seriously mentally ill people, and they're just shuddering because every time a shooting goes on, I say, well, it's one of them.
Thank you. So anyway, just to say, I think we have to stop here pretty soon. But what I wanted to start with demon possession, because that's sort of the farthest out of any of us beyond medicine that we're used to. And certainly tomorrow, let's talk more about the healing that you've experienced and combinations of, I'll just leave you with one other thing about that. The religion and science, so I taught a religion and science module in this Gospels class with the associate director of the Zygon Center for Religion and Science, a nuclear biologist named Gail Woloshek, Greek Orthodox, wonderful. So she took us to her lab. She's doing everything she can to cure cancer. I mean, she works at the cellular level to try to cure, and cancers, every one of them is different, so it's individual cancers. But she also has written an article in a book with a pastoral care colleague. It's called Chance, Necessity, and Love. And she presented this in our class, that mutations are really, really vital for our own safety and for human evolution. The mutations are always going on in our bodies to fight off new microbes, and mutations are really, really important. But she points out, every so often you get a bad mutation. And if anybody gets 6 or 7 of those, that means you're going to get cancer. I'm very much oversimplifying, but it's in an article that she wrote, and it's also in this book. And so she said, it's chance who gets that. I mean, I think we get too fixated maybe on thinking, you cause your own cancer by smoking or by eating the wrong stuff or whatever. No, she says mutations are chance. There's a few things you can do, but by and large. So the idea is, if you accept the idea that we need mutations in order to be human, none of us would be here from an evolutionary standpoint if there hadn't been mutations, we evolved. But genetic mutations are going to happen, and some of them aren't good. And so her view is the people then who are carrying cancer because they got the six or seven mutations. And the people with mental illness, even, she would say, are carrying something on behalf of all of us. Her brother, for example, I think is schizophrenic. And she says the Neanderthals don't have the genes for mental illness, for bipolar, that Homo sapiens sapiens do. You can actually look at Neanderthal DNA now and see that. But to be human, to have this level of brain, cognitive memory and everything, it appears that that also means what goes along with it is that some people are going to carry a kind of mental illness that wasn't the case for Neanderthals and stuff. So, and same thing with cancers, that in her view, even though she's trying to cure cancer, I mean, that would be great if every genetic mutation could be cured before, you know, somebody dies of cancer. But we should then, what it means from an ethics standpoint is that we as a community need to care for one another, because that could just as well have been me, that person with the cancer. It just happens that I didn't get those six or seven mutations, but that person did, and we all need mutations. So that it's this model then that compassion and caring for one another in community is the most important response that we can have once you understand sort of human evolution and how cancers evolve and some other diseases as well, that these people are members of our community who just happen to get this really bad hand dealt to them, but the only response that makes sense is compassion. So whatever that makes us think about healthcare and other things, I'm just coming back again and again to this idea of community, that we carry one another, and health and disability and disease are all part of this as well, as we think in terms of the Gospels and Jesus' healing ministry. So I'll leave you. Maureen?
Can I just say one thing that's connected with this corporate compassion? I was in Madagascar for a couple of
years. Oh, yeah, good. Tell us about
that. I went to some worship services, and one of them was at a healing center. It was called a Tubi, and it was where the people would bring their sick. The family would come with them, and they would be in this community of healing. And we were there on Sunday for worship, and the whole community came. So there were like 1,000 people in this worship space. No roof. The roof had blown off in a storm. But the sick people were gathered in the center, in the middle. And at a certain point in the service, a number of people called Yandri, they were shepherds, were blessed, and white robes were put on them. And then they went out into the community to cast out demons. And they shouted, you know, in the name of Jesus, come out to all of us. And you know, they would go specifically to the sick people, but it was kind of a general casting out of demons, collectively for this whole community of 1,000 people. And then people could come individually to one of these shepherds and have hands laid on and prayers spoken, and it collected the community around the sick people to lay on hands and say prayers. And to me, it felt like, you know, I was told by a medical doctor in what ways this was particularly, that it worked really well, but it was so much more communal than some of my experience of illness, which separates you from your community. And sometimes you're off in the hospital and your whole family isn't there eating a meal with you, and the whole community's not gathering around you. And there was real power in that. It's a little bit different subject, but than Jesus' own healings. But the connection for me is mostly with the lepers who were separated from the community. Mm-hmm. And Jesus says, show yourself to the priest and come back into community. And anyway.
Thank you. No, I think that's so important, that the restoration to community might be at the very heart of healing. And that they in Madagascar have a way of dealing with healing that doesn't end up like those TV preachers. You know, if you really had enough faith, you would be healed. You'd be able to leave that crutch and go. That's our, you know, that's the horrifying dimension of the healing, but we've got to get beyond that. So thank you so much. And that's what Sharon Betcher brings up in this article that I will leave in the library if anybody wants to read it before tomorrow, because we have to talk. talk about that. Thank you so much. And others as well. I'll leave more time for discussion tomorrow. Apologies. But I do want to hear from all of you about your experiences and perspectives on this issue, especially cross-culturally. And we can look at some segments of the video, too. Thank you.